Chapter 23. Before sunrise next morning, Dobbs was on his way. Once started, the pack train traveled fairly well. The burros were more willing than they had been yesterday, as they had not been forced to wait so long after being loaded, and Dobbs had given them their ration of corn, which made them more lively. Then one burro became frightened, for some unknown reason, and ran against trees and rocks, breaking the straps, ropes, and girth, which held packs and pack saddle. Free of this, he ran away like mad. Dobbs was unable to catch up with him, and had to let him go. So he divided the packs and loaded them on the other animals. He was sure the burro would later follow up and come to camp at night, looking for his pals. Now Dobbs could see the railroad at almost every turn the trail made, because the trail led, from now on, down the mountains, straight into the valley. He could have reached one of the smaller stations along the railroad this very day, but he thought it better not to board a train at one of the small depots, where he might easily arouse suspicion, appearing alone with so many loaded burros. Then, too, he could not expect to sell his burros and tools in a small village. Dobbs needed cash to pay for his ticket and the freight charges, so he must go to Durango, the nearest city. Durango was still 2 long days off, if not 3. The trail became easier and apparently safer on nearing town. Dobbs began to feel fine. He whistled. Getting along so easily, he could dream about his future, what he would do with his riches, where and how he was going to live. He contemplated a trip to Europe, to France, and to England and Scotland, where he could have for once a plate of real haggis of the kind his mother had talked about when he was a boy. "If I only could know for sure that he's dead, and that he's been eaten by a tiger or something." He spoke so loud that the burro in front of him turned his head, thinking perhaps maybe Dobbs had given him an order. That night when Dobbs pitched camp, he felt easier than on the 2 previous nights. He knew his conscience would not trouble him here. Such things only happened in the mountains, where trees seemed to speak and foliage to frame strange faces. Here, in full view of the plain, he found real tranquility. He sang and whistled as he cooked his meal. The burro that had broken away during the day now came walking into the camp.
"That means good luck," Dobbs said. "Getting something back which seemed lost for good?
I like that. Besides, it means $15 more cash in my pocket. Hello, old pal. How are you?" He greeted the returned member of the family and patted him on the back. That night, Dobbs slept well. Not once did he wake up thinking he had heard voices or footsteps, as he had the 2 preceding nights. At noon next day, while crossing a hill, he caught sight of Durango in the distance, bathed in golden sunshine, and nestled beside one of the wonders of the world, El Cerro del Mercado, a mountain which consists of more than 600 million tons of pure iron. What a lovely city, with its balmy air and its beautiful surroundings. Evening saw Dobbs for the last time, cooking his meal in a camp and living like a savage. Next day he would be in the city, sleeping in a good bed in a hotel, sitting at a real table with well-cooked food before him, served by a bowing waiter. 2 days later, he would be riding in a train, which would take him in 2 or 3 days to the good old home country. He was all jubilation. He sang and whistled and danced. He was now safe. He could see the flares of the oil-fed engine sweeping along the railroad tracks, could hear the trains rolling by and the coughing and bellowing of the engine. These sounds gave him a great feeling of security. They were the sounds of civilization. He longed for civilization, for law, for justice, which would protect his property and his person with a police force. Within this civilization, he could face Howard without fear, and even Curtin, should he ever show up again. There he could sneer at them and ridicule them. There they would have to use civilized means to prove their accusations. If those bums should go too far, he could easily accuse them of blackmailing him. He would then be a fine citizen, well-dressed, able to afford the best lawyers. What a fine thing civilization is, he thought, and he felt happy that no such nonsense as Bolshevism could take away his property and his easy life. Again an engine barked through the night. To Dobbs, it was sweet music. The music of law, protection, and safety.
Strange, he said suddenly, waking from his dreams. Really strange, I should say. He didn't cry, that guy didn't, when I slugged him. He did not whine or make a sound, just dropped like a felled tree. The blood that trickled from his breast and soaked his shirt was the only thing that moved. When I came with that burning stick and looked at him once more, his face was white. I thought I might have the quivers, but hell, I didn't. Why should I? I could have laughed. That's what I could. Laughed right out. He looked so funny the way his legs and arms were twisted about, almost like a coiled snake. It sure was funny. Dobbs laughed. Just a slug, and finished a whole guy that cared so much about his life and work. Funny things are. Really funny. All things are funny. He smoked and watched the little clouds before his face. If I only had the slightest notion where that body can be, I simply can't figure it out. Carried off by a lion? Likely. Lots of mountain lions about. Found by an Indian and taken to his village? No, I don't think so. Anyway, suppose the body was carried away by a tiger or a cougar. I would have seen the tracks where he was dragged over the ground. The trouble is, I didn't look for tracks. I just looked for him. That was the mistake I made. Hell, I should have looked more carefully for tracks of wild beasts. Now, let's see. Yes, I think that tiger, or what it was, took him up in his jaws and carried him off without leaving any tracks. That's it. Hell, tigers are strong. Must have been a tiger. A Tigre Real. A royal tiger. Those big tigers are awfully strong and can easily carry away a whole cow, jumping with her over a fence. They are really big and strong. Dobbs felt satisfied with the explanation he had given himself. Perhaps he isn't dead at all. Ah, nonsense. He's dead all right. I slugged him fine. Didn't I see the blood, and his white face, and his twisted body, and his closed eyes, which didn't quiver, not a bit, when I touched them with a burning stick? He was as dead as that stone here. He sure was. Dobbs grew uneasy. He began to shiver. He stirred the fire and pushed in a few more logs. He looked down across the plains, hoping to see flickers of light from the huts where small farmers lived. He turned his head toward the brush, sure that he'd heard someone coming. At last, he could sit no longer. He had to stand up and walk about the fire. He told himself he did so only because he felt cold and had to walk to get warm. But the truth was that he wanted to look around more freely. He would have felt better had he had a high brick wall against his back to be sure that no one could be behind him. As he stood quietly for a moment, he thought that he felt somebody behind him, so close that he had the sensation of breath on his neck. He imagined he felt the point of a knife in his back. He sprang forward, drew his gun, and, turning, aimed at nothing. No one was threatening him. He saw nothing but the dark shadows of the burrows grazing peacefully near the camp. Dobbs looked at them and thought for a second how happy animals are because they cannot think as human beings can. He told himself that he was not nervous at all, that in the wilderness one must be always on guard. To be always on the alert is the mark of a true woodman, and it has nothing whatever to do with what people call conscience. That's sheer nonsense. Alone, and so far from civilization, and with valuable goods, one cannot be too careful. Anybody might sneak up from behind and try to get the better of him, and then make off with the booty. Not me, Dobbs said half aloud. No one can get me that easy. I know how to protect my hide. I'm not a yellow sissy like that Lakey guy or that Well, he had no guts. I'm tough, I sure am. No sneaking up behind me, no sir. He made an effort to chuckle and sat down by the fire and tried to concentrate his thoughts on the job of cleaning his pipe. Next morning, Dobbs could not leave as early as he had planned. Several of the burros had strayed. He had been careless last night in hobbling them, and they had gone looking for better pasture. He lost hours in rounding them up. The trail soon ran into a wide dirt road, covered with fine dust and sand that made traveling on it a torture. Dobbs figured he would be in Durango about 3 p.m. Had it not been for the loss of so many valuable hours in the morning, he would have been at the first houses of the town by now. The road was tiresome to travel. One side of it lay along cultivated fields, now dried up for months. The rich soil was at present like powder. The other side of the road was partly walled in by a long hill of soft earth, a sort of clay of a yellowish-brownish color.
thorny bushes and magais and nopales and organos growing along the road and partly fencing in the fields were quickly covered with white dust. When a breeze rose, huge clouds of dust swept over the fields and made the road ahead almost invisible, as if wrapped in a heavy fog. Often Dobbs could not see further ahead than 10 feet, but this was not the real trouble, because he and the animals could find their way. It was the heavy dust sweeping in from all directions which made breathing a real pain. The fine sand, which was like powdered glass, nearly blinded Dobbs, reddening his eyes and making it painful to open or close them. Above was a merciless sun, the pitiless sun of midday in the tropics. For months the earth had waited for rain, and not a drop had fallen in this section. The heat broke upon man and beast until they were numb in mind and body, so that they closed their eyes and staggered along, not wishing anything from life but an end of this painful march. The burros no longer strayed and nibbled at dry leaves of grass by the road. They plodded on like automatons. They hardly moved even their heads. From former experience, they knew that a town means rest, protection against heat and dust, and water and food. So they hurried on toward this town, which to them, as to Dobbs, under these circumstances, was the promised land. Then, through his almost closed eyes, Dobbs noted a few trees growing near the road. They were low, but they had thick, very wide crowns, and offered a most welcome shade. Here he could sit down for a while and lean his tired body against a tree, have a drink of water and a smoke, and after that, make the rest of the way refreshed. Even the burros would welcome the opportunity to stand in the shade for a few minutes. The first shacks of the town were hardly 5 miles away. Dobbs hurried ahead to turn the leading burro about. The animals came willingly to the trees. They panted, shook their heads to free them from horseflies, and then moved slowly about in the cooling shade. Dobbs went to one of the burros, took the water bag from the saddle, rinsed his mouth of the dust which was grinding between his teeth, and then drank. He poured some water into his hands and wet his face and neck. As he turned the water bag to the saddle, he heard somebody say, "Tiene un cigarro, hombre? Have you got a cigarette?" Dobbs started. This was the first human voice he had heard for days, and it came to his ears with a shock. Although the words were spoken in Spanish, Dobbs thought first of Howard and Curtin, realizing at the same moment that they would not speak to him in this way. Turning his head in the direction the voice had come from, he saw 3 ragged tramps lying in a hollow under one of the trees farthest away toward the field. They were mestizos, unwashed, uncombed, with ugly faces, types that are frequently met on the roads in the vicinity of cities, where they can sleep free of charge and wait for any opportunities the road may offer. Their look alone gave evidence that they had not worked for months and had reached the state where they no longer cared about finding a job, having tried in vain 1,000 times. They were the human sweepings of the cities, left on the dumps of civilization, possibly escaped convicts, outlaws, fugitives from justice. They were the garbage of civilization, with their headquarters near all the other garbage and junk a modern city spits out unceasingly, day and night. Seeing these 3 empty tin cans of modern civilization, Dobbs, once in his life having been one of them himself, knew immediately that he was in one of the toughest situations he would ever have to face. He realized that he had made a mistake in leaving the open road and turning to the trees. The road was only about 50 feet away, but screened by these trees many things could happen, and of course, out on the road, he might not have been much safer. Dobbs had no plan. He could only try to gain time in the hope that someone might pass by whom he might hail. He might convince the thieves that he had no money and nothing of value, but this would not be easy. His packs and his burros were enough to induce them to commit any crime to get possession of them. "I haven't got a cigarette," he answered, trying to be nonchalant. "In fact, I haven't had a cigarette myself for more than 10 months. He thought he had said something clever. He would show them that he was so poor that he could not even buy himself a package of cigarettes. He added, "But I've got a few pinches of tobacco, if that will do."
"And paper to roll it in?"
one of the men asked.
"Or a few corn leaves?"
The 3 thieves were still lying on the ground, their faces turned toward Dobbs. They were so well shielded by the trees that they could not be seen from the road. Had Dobbs seen them, he would not have turned off the road, but would have driven the burros hard to escape. "It's too late now," Dobbs thought with regret.
Well, I've got a bit of newspaper, if that will do. He pulled out his pouch and produced a piece of paper, wet with the sweat from his body. He handed this to the man nearest him. The three men divided the piece of paper, took the pouch, and rolled their cigarettes.
Cerillos? Matches?
One asked, as if ordering Dobbs to wait on him. Dobbs ignored the insolence and handed them the box of matches. They lit their cigarettes and returned the box.
Going to Durango?
One asked. Well, yes, that's my intention. I'm going to sell the burros. I need money. I haven't got a red cent. Dobbs thought this answer clever again.
Money? Exactly what we need, don't we, partners?
One said.
Do we need it?
Another answered and broke into laughter. Dobbs leaned against a tree so that he could keep them in view. He filled his pipe and lighted it. He took his time, for he wanted to impress on these men that he was in no way worried, or worse, afraid. He was no longer tired. I might hire them as drivers. He reflected. That would not look so suspicious as if I came into town alone with so many pack burros. They might like to earn a peso or two without hard work. Then they'd have a good meal and a drink coming their way. It was an excellent idea, he was sure.
Well, I could use a good mule driver, even two or three. Could you?
One of the men was laughing. Well, yes, I sure could. These burros make me trouble enough.
How much is the pay?
1 peso.
1 peso for us three?
Well, no, of course not. 1 peso for each one of you. Well, naturally, I can't pay in advance. I'll pay when we get to town and I've got some cash.
Naturally,
one said. Another asked.
Are you alone?
Dobbs hesitated, but not wishing to give the impression that he had no answer ready, he said.
Oh, no, I'm not alone. How could I be? Two of my friends are coming on horseback. They'll be here any minute now. That's strange. Don't you think so, Miguel?
One of the men said to another, who was watching Dobbs with glittering eyes, while his mouth was an open slit in which the point of his tongue could just be seen.
Yes, that's strange. Very strange, very.
Miguel answered, licking his lips.
Strange indeed. This man is all by himself on a dangerous road with a long train, and his friends are coming behind on horseback, pleasure riding. Strange, I should say. Muy raro.
Do you see the friends on horseback coming, Pablo?
Asked the one who seemed the laziest of all. Pablo rose slowly, went over to the road and looked toward the mountains, came back indolently, and said with a grin on his thick lips,
No, these two friends are still far behind, far back an hour or more. I can't even see a pinch of dust swirling up from their horses.
So you lied to us. Well.
Miguel said, his tongue playing about his lips.
Well. And what is it you have in the packs, pal? Let us have a look at the goods.
He rose heavily, as if it were too much work to get up from the ground, walked over to one of the burros, and with his fist, pushed and poked the packs.
Seems to me like hides.
It is hides, you are right. Dobbs felt more uneasy every minute, and was anxious to get away as quickly as possible.
Tigre real, royal tiger?
Oh, yes, a tiger and a few lions.
Bring quite a little bit of dough.
Well, I hope so. Dobbs said it casually, to hide his growing uneasiness. He went to one of the burros and tightened the straps. Then he walked over to another and rattled the packs to see if they were still holding fast. Then he tightened his own belt and pulled his pants higher up, indicating that he was ready to make off. Well, boys, I figure I'll have to beat it now. Only stop for a bit of cool breeze under these trees, anyway. Have to be in town long before evening. He knocked his pipe against the heel of his left boot. Now, which one of you is willing to come along with me and help handle the bestias? The burros, I mean. He glanced at the three men, at the same time circling the donkeys so as to keep them together. None of the three answered. They merely looked at each other. Dobbs caught one of these glances. He understood, and his breath stopped for a second. It flashed through his mind that he had seen many a movie in which the hero was trapped in a situation like this. But he realized at the same time that he could not remember one single picture in which the producer had not done his utmost to help the trapped hero out again to save the girl from the clutches of a bunch of villains. Before he could think of any of the tricks he had seen in the pictures, by which the hero finally escaped, he felt, with a strange bitterness in his mouth, that this situation here was real. And whatever is real is different. No smart film producer was on hand to open the trap with a good trick.
Dobbs kicked the nearest burrow in its hams until it took the lead and set out on its way toward town. Another followed slowly. The rest continued to nibble at the meager grass growing under the trees. Dobbs rounded them up and tried to get them all started on their way. The three tramps stood up and, as if they meant to tease a bit, edged in among the burrows that still lingered behind. The animals, used to marching with the rest of the pack train, became restless and tried to break past the men and reach their fellows. At this, the three men endeavored openly to prevent the remaining burros from following the others. They grasped the ropes and held on to the saddles to keep the burros from moving on. Dobbs, 10 feet away, shouted,
"Get away from my burros!"
"Who? And just what?"
Miguel sneered.
"We can sell these burros as well as you can. They won't be any worse if we sell them. What do you think, muchachos?"
He asked his companions.
"Away from those burros, I tell you!"
Dobbs yelled, his face red with fury. He jumped further back and drew his gun. Miguel, seeing this move, failed to show either fear or surprise, as Dobbs had expected.
"With that chingando iron of yours, you can't frighten even a sick louse."
He chuckled sarcastically.
"Not us, you dirty funking cabron. You can only shoot one, and whoever you bump off won't mind much, because the Federales are after him anyway, and if they catch him, they won't live another half hour. So what is your gat? We take that chance."
Once more, Dobbs yelled at the top of his voice,
"Get back there from my burrows!"
Without waiting for the men to move, he aimed at the one nearest him. It was Miguel. But the gun clicked cold. Twice, three times, five times the gun clicked without making even the fish of a toy gun. Dobbs stared at his gun in amazement. So did the three thieves. They were so surprised at the failure of that gun that they forgot to laugh or to sneer or to say a single word or utter an exclamation. One of them bent slowly down and picked up a heavy stone. A short second followed, filled with such tension that Dobbs thought the whole world would explode. And in this second, Dobbs remembered as clearly as if he were living it over once more why it came about that his gun would not fire. Curtin had disarmed Dobbs to prevent being killed. Curtin had unloaded the gun and put it in his own belt for safekeeping. When Dobbs, the following night, disarmed Curtin, he had shot him with Curtin's gun. Then he had taken his own gun back, but in the excitement in which he had lived during the last few days, he had forgotten to reload his gun, and he had thrown Curtin's gun, after he had shot him for the second time, upon the body to let the discoverer of the body figure out what had happened and how. Still, before this same second came to an end, Dobbs' mind worked intensely to think of another means of defense. His glance fell upon a machete tied to the saddle of the nearest burrow. This weapon-like tool was for use in cutting a new trail when fallen trees blocked the way or the underbrush had grown too dense for the burrows to pass. He grasped the haft of this machete, but before he could pull it out of its sheath, the stone one of the thieves had taken up crashed against his forehead. He fell. Before he could rise to his feet, Miguel, who had noted Dobbs' move toward the machete, jumped close up. With the sure grip of an expert, he had the machete out in an instant. Tiger-like, he sprang at the fallen Dobbs, and, with a short, powerful stroke, he cut off Dobbs' head. A mighty gush of blood rushed forth from the body. More startled than frightened, the three men looked at the body, which was still quivering. The head lay only an inch from the neck. The eyelids blinked two or three times rapidly, and then became fixed, but only partly closed. Several times the hands spread wide open, and then cramped into fists, finally closing more gently as life fled away and the nerves stiffened.
"You did that, Miguel,"
Pablo said in a low voice, coming nearer.
"Ah, shut up, you damn yellow dog. Why didn't you do it? Afraid of that funking son of a bitch by a stinking gringo, eh? I know who did it and bumped him, and I tell you, get away from me, both you chingando cabrones, and que chinguen los cabrones a la matriculas. Do I need your stinking advice, you puppies? Out of my way. You make me sick looking at you, you dirty rats."
He stared at the machete. There was not much blood on it. He wondered why. But the stroke had been that of a master hand. He did not realize how good he was, how great an expert. He stepped to the nearest tree, rubbed the machete clean against the bark, then, wetting his fingers with his tongue, tested the edge, and, satisfied with his inspection, pushed the machete back into its scabbard.